This is 89.9 WWNL. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. It's carnival time, and we're ready to let loose and have some fun. Whether you're in the mood for a bayou boat parade, a visit to the stables to see how the horses get dressed for their big show, tips on how to follow your nose for great food on Carnival Day, or a concert prelude to the Lenten season, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. A little rain and cooler temperatures are no match for New Orleanians bent on throwing the world's greatest free celebration. We just bundle up and party on. Hey, Mardi Gras, Carnival 2014 is here. How are you getting your Mardi Gras on? Did you get up early to catch a Zulu coconut? Or strut down St. Charles Avenue to hail King Rex? Maybe you're at the truck parade right about now with bags of throws overflowing. Did you catch a glimpse of a Mardi Gras Indian? When you're watching a Mardi Gras parade, what gets you most excited? The floats? The throws? The marching bands? One New Orleans native has loved carnival since she was a little girl, but not for any of these reasons. She loves it for the horses. WWNO's Lane Kaplan-Levinson picks up the story.
This isn't always what it sounds like here. This is a horse tied to four corners of a stall from each limb over at Cascade Stables. The horse is getting shoed by one of the blacksmiths, which seems like a brief yet uncomfortable process. It's one of a few necessary steps the staff goes through in preparing their horses for Mardi Gras season. Assistant trainer Scooter Sherrick explains.
First things first, we take care of their feet. Our blacksmith here goes through and shoes all the horses. We put Boreum shoes on so they don't slip on the concrete. We'll go through and we'll body clip, which means we'll take all the hair off of them, make them shorter haired where they're more comfortable and they won't be sweating as much, and give them all baths, ride them, and then they're ready to go.
Cascade Stables is one of the top 20 show stables in the country. For most of the year, the focus is trail rides, lessons, and attending and hosting horse shows. But for 1 month out of the year, as is the case for most people and places in this town, the usual routine is put on hold.
We will put probably 300 horses collectively on the street during Mardi Gras. We do all the major parades.
That's Barbie Smith, Scooter's mom. She runs Cascade Stables and has been connected to the institution before it was in Audubon Park and before she owned the place.
I started riding at Audubon Stables when I was 6 years old, took lessons here for years, and I remember standing on the streets at Mardi Gras and not really caring about the beads or the riders, but I knew every horse that came through that parade, and that was really cool. And my father put me in business in 1981 when we bid on the stables, and we've just held the tradition.
Barbie provides all the horses for every Old Line parade, from Babylon to Chaos to Hermes to Rex, as well as a few New Line parades like Bacchus and Endymion. And some of these parades need over 30 horses, which is why Barbie calls in backup.
Every year we buy approximately 20 horses for Mardi Gras, some of which have been rescued, and we try to give them good homes after Mardi Gras. And we even have six or seven that I ship to other show stables around the country. They use them for their lessons all year, and then they send them back for the week of Mardi Gras, and then I send them back. We've got horses in Tennessee, Kentucky, Missouri, all over.
Testing which horses to use for the parades and which ones to keep after the festivities is easy. Put a young rider on the horse and see what happens. Well, not really, but kind of.
It's really fun. I was watching a couple kids ride today, and they're all riding new Mardi Gras horses. They work them, and they take care of them, and they brush them, and they fall in love with them, because we always keep three or four or five of them, you know, as our regular lesson horses. So they're all kind of vying for that position.
What's interesting about the tradition of crew lieutenants and officers riding horses today is that most of these people don't have any experience riding horses at all, except for their one parade. That's why each horse has a walker or groom to accompany the often inexperienced royal rider. Barbie's son Scooter takes on this task.
We put a walker with every horse that goes into the parade, no matter what. I mean, every horse has a walker, whether they know how to ride, whether they don't, anything. Every horse has a walker. So I usually just do the captain of Rex, just because it's Rex and that's the main guy, and got to have somebody trustworthy for that one.
But there are still concerns that cause Barbie to bring along backup horses in case one of them gets spooked in some way and needs to be pulled from the parade and replaced.
Well, we always worry about the crowd. We worry about guys falling off and getting hurt, but it's a risk. They've outlawed snapping pops this year, thank goodness, those things they throw in front of the horses, so that'll help us greatly, because that would get guys thrown. You know, the bands all of a sudden hitting their drums and their cymbals and everything else when the horses don't see it coming can be kind of scary, but for the most part, they do really, really well.
They all do well, but of course there has to be a star. The captain's horse is the horse that's up at the front of each parade. It's always a white horse, and for the past 16 years, it's been Cascade Stables General De Gaulle, but
he just died this year, and we all took it very, very badly. And this year we bought a new horse. We named him Mystic, and he came from Shelbyville, Tennessee, and this is going to be his first year as the lead horse. So he's got some big shoes to step into, and we're hoping he does good.
But some things will remain the same. After the horses are bathed, clipped, and shoed, there's one final step that is essential in order to roll: looking pretty.
We paint all their feet gold. That's how you'll know they're ours. We French braid their tails with gold ribbons. We clean the saddles and bridles. We try to make a great presentation, and the gold feet just are something special. And a lot of people on the street comment on how beautiful they are. And the French braids with the braids in their tails, that's something that I developed that we've just always done.
So now you know what to look for when you're out on the parade route and what it took that horse and its staff to get there. For WWNO, I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson.
This story is brought to you in partnership with NOLA V and is made possible with the assistance of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Right about now, I could eat a bowl of gumbo with a dollop of potato salad. How about you? Are you looking for memorable meals during Carnival in New Orleans? Well, food writer Ian McNulty says the answer may come courtesy of entrepreneurial home cooking near the parade routes.
Conventional wisdom holds that Carnival is a lousy time to go looking for the celebrated food culture of New Orleans. That this season of parades and balls and late night parties is when our town's intense fixation on food takes a breather. But I disagree. In my experience, the focus just shifts a bit, and this new look can be rewarding and memorable in its own right. True, many restaurants close or significantly alter their operations, though a great deal do soldier on right through to Fat Tuesday itself. But first and foremost, Carnival happens on the streets, and that's where to look for its imprint on the way New Orleans eats. Yes, it's easy to succumb to funnel cake and corn dogs from the blaring and bright carny carts that descend with the season. But there is so much more homegrown food out there these days. The city's ad hoc fleet of food trucks has greatly increased the quality and diversity of street food, from Korean chicken tacos to falafels with shredded beets to poutine, a type of cheese fries, to name just a few of the options out there. But these roving kitchens are limited in number, and they can't be everywhere. But what does seem to be everywhere, or at least everywhere around the Uptown Parade route, is something I call entrepreneurial home cooking. This comes from people setting up shop near the route, sometimes in their front yards or behind the fence line of their church or school, to put on the equivalent of a Mardi Gras bake sale of simple, satisfying, bedrock delicious New Orleans cooking. In years past, I've had red, meaty jambalaya in a paper bowl from a folding table by the sidewalk, and sauce-soaked ribs pulled from a trailer-mounted smoker wedged up against someone's porch. I've had my pick from a veritable buffet of slow cookers filled with stew and gumbo and dirty rice. And last year, my Endymion Saturday unexpectedly began with breakfast burritos sold from a makeshift diner counter a neighbor installed in his garage. The burritos didn't seem particularly New Orleansy, but the Go Cup Bloody Mary supplied to wash them down sure did. The lineup of these homemade street eats is in constant flux, changing up as the financial goals, supplies, parade schedules, and individual ambitions adjust. That means it's impossible to make any recommendations day to day, much less year to year. That little barbecue stand might be blowing and going on Friday night, but just plain gone by Saturday. But keep your eyes peeled and keep an open mind. We know it's helpful to have a game plan for Mardi Gras, but in my experience, it's also vital to stay open for spontaneity, and that holds true when we're talking about food during Mardi Gras. Most of this activity is, of course, unlicensed, uninspected, and unregulated. Maybe that's off-putting to some, and maybe it runs counter to the greater scrutiny that goes into so much of what we do or eat or buy these days. But it's fine with me. It's Mardi Gras, after all. And if everything we experience during this time of year had to be regulated and approved, well, it wouldn't make for a very fat Tuesday, would it? Learn more at WWNO.org.
Now we turn to the Storyville series. This is a piece about a Mardi Gras Bayou boat parade to get you thinking about Carnival, as if you aren't already.
This is Storyville, true stories by students in the Creative Writing Workshop at the University of New Orleans. Today's story is about poets and lunatics. Here's When Jesters Have Their Day, written and read by Adam Carlin.
The guy next to me is wearing an orange fur coat and a red feather boa. His wife is dressed as a giant grape. Someone playing the trumpet looks like a cross between a post office employee and a Mad Max road warrior. I'm wearing an inflatable alligator on my head. This is the Bayou Boat Parade, which happens on Lundi Gras, the Monday before Fat Tuesday. It's simple. Folks get in boats and have an aquatic second line up Bayou St. John. Anyone can join, as long as they have a floatable watercraft. Or not so floatable. The trombone player's kayak is starting to list. I'm with a bunch of misfits, poets, lunatics, artists, and general quirks. Some of us run nonprofits. Some are professional musicians. One is a bartender, one is a lawyer, and one is working his way through law school as a bartender. There are about 2 dozen boats paddling away, accompanied by a brass band that's desperately trying not to sink under the muck. This is the Mardi Gras I love, the one where the whole social order is flipped on its head. I don't like the old line parades much. I'm put off when crew members wear masks and hats to conceal their identity, even as they toss beads to the crowds they're hiding from. Everyone screams and pushes for a bit of worthless plastic thrown by someone who won't even show you their face. I find this kind of medieval, feudal even. I prefer the Mardi Gras where the jesters rule the kings. In medieval times, the rulers knew something like this needed to happen at least once a year. The common folk, especially the agitators, needed a day when they felt like the world was theirs. I love that in New Orleans, the agitators often have the run of the place. Mardi Gras and carnival season is the time of year when this sort of thing is most evident. But the jester is always a threat to the monarchy here. The misfit toys who just don't fit in anywhere else, they find a home. They find tolerance and creativity and the best of southern hospitality and warmth at the same time. That's a heady combination to drink off of, and not to engage in New Orleans cliches, but we drink a lot down here. But we're also, and this may shock outsiders even if natives know it, pretty religious. Old-time religion. And that's not just the Catholics. The jesters and the weirdos live for the rituals as well. Because rituals are a binding thing, and I think that cohesion is more important than the laissez-faire, do-what-you-wanna vibe. I mean, you can do what you wanna anywhere, really, but where else are you treated like family when you do? For all that community, this city celebrates individuality like nowhere else. You come to the party in costume, as a Mardi Gras Indian, or a purple and gold king, or a leather queen, or a jester with an alligator on your head. But ultimately, all that disparate lunacy gives way to a combined voice. You hear it in this song out in the bayou. It can't decide if it wants to laugh or sing, so it does both, loud and long and echoing across the water.
Adam Carlin writes for a variety of print and online media. He's penned 3 editions of Lonely Planet's New Orleans Guide. Storyville's opening theme is composed and played by Irvin Mayfield. This is a production of WWNO in New Orleans. I'm Richard Goodman.
The music you heard in that piece is an original recording taken during last year's parade on Bayou St. John. You can find photos and a video from Lundi Gras 2013 at our website, wwno.org. Storyville is produced by Lane Kaplan Levinson. Mardi Gras officially ends this evening at the stroke of midnight, ushering in the first day of the Lenten season, Ash Wednesday, as Christians prepare for the resurrection of Christ on Easter Sunday. The Pirates Alley Faulkner Society and its subsidiary, Words and Music, are among the sponsors of a series of six public concerts being presented by the Archdiocese of New Orleans at historic St. Mary's Catholic Church in the French Quarter during Lent. Renowned tenor, native son, and opera-performing artist Fernando del Valle kicks off the series with a concert of Baroque and spiritually-oriented classical music. He joins us now with Father William Maestri of the Archdiocese of New Orleans. Gentlemen, welcome to Inside the Arts.
We're delighted to be with you.
Thank you.
Fernando, you were born in New Orleans.
Yes, I sure was.
And your given name is Brian Skinner.
Yes.
How did you come to adopt the name Fernando del Valle?
I took the name because at the beginning of my career, I needed a theatrical name. And since my voice has a very Mediterranean timbre, I was encouraged to change it to a theatrical name. And my grandfather's name happened to be Fernando del Valle, who was the president of El Salvador in 1876, I believe, my great-grandfather. And so I chose that name. It was a very theatrical name, very beautiful, and part of my heritage.
You have performed on the international stage. Tell me, what will you bring to this Lenten concert series?
Well, I chose a program of primarily religious music by the classical composers of César Franck, Gounod, Bach, Handel, and all things that go within the theme of Lent. I'm going to sing a beautiful aria from the opera Faust, O Divine Redeemer, in French. This aria was written for the heroine Marguerite, who basically dies to redeem Faust, who has sold his soul to the devil. And in her last prayer before she's executed, she asks God to give her soul to forgive Christ. And I think that is the overall theme of Lent, and of forgiveness and rebirth. So that's one of the pieces I've chosen specifically to do.
You're also going to sing Ave Maria?
I sure am. In two different versions, one by Bach Gounod, which is the most famous version, and the other one by Robert Stolz, who is an Austrian operetta composer. So it's a more of a popular theme, musically easy listening. It's really a ravishing arrangement.
Now, when did you know that you were destined for a career in operatic song?
Well, I think it kind of happened by accident. I started as a pianist, and then my voice started developing. So my parents chose for me to go to Brother Martin, because they had a very good men's choir there. And so my training really was singing in that men's chorus. And through those years, my voice developed. And in tandem with that, I also sang in a lot of the local churches.
And what was your big break?
My big break was when I went to Europe and I was hired to sing the role of Don José in Treviso in Italy. That's in Veneto, right about, say, an hour from Milano. I was chosen to sing the role of Don José in Carmen in this very controversial production under the direction of a very famous voice teacher, Regina Resnick. And so from that point on, I was approached by several managers, and then my career basically took off from there.
Now, Father Maestri, these concerts are free and open to the public, but they do support a new mission by the Archdiocese in downtown New Orleans. Tell us about the Bishop Perry Center, which you oversee, and its mission.
The Bishop Perry Center is the first ministry offered by the Archdiocese that deals directly with community outreach in meeting the needs of those who are most at risk, the poorest of the poor among us, on a spiritual as well as material, educational, and physical needs. We also have a component to the center that addresses the arts and music. And we've had various music and cultural activities at the center as well. And it serves the Vucare area, the Marigny, and the Bywater areas of the city of New Orleans.
Now, where is the center located?
The center is located at 1941 Dauphine Street, right on the corner of Dauphine and Touro.
So how does this series of concerts help you and the center?
We are a nonprofit, and we are totally dependent upon donations, volunteers, and the goodwill of people in the community, which I might add, the people in the Marigny have enthusiastically embraced the center. It also allows us to expand our area of ministry. We have a fledgling medical program in which a doctor and a nurse come in once a week on a Friday. And also we are developing an eye component with the Lions Club and also a dental hygienist program, which is very, very important in that area, especially for the population we serve.
Now, the concerts are being held in St. Mary's Church. Tell me about this historic landmark.
St. Mary's Church is located on 1100 Charters down in the lower part of the Vucare. It's associated with and attached to the historic Ursuline Convent, which is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, building in the Mississippi Valley. The church was damaged with Katrina, and I'm happy to say that we have reopened St. Mary's as of last year.
Can you tell me what is your hope for those attending the series?
To consider the things that really matter in our life. And I think that music, especially this kind of music, is a wonderful vehicle for getting us to think beyond ourselves and yet at the same time look within ourselves.
Father William Maestri of the Archdiocese of New Orleans and internationally acclaimed tenor Fernando Del Valle, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much for having us, Diane.
Fernando Del Valle kicks off the musical prelude to the celebration of Easter, a series of free public concerts staged at St. Mary's Catholic Church, 1116 Charter Street, Thursday at 6 p.m. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.